One in five American children is growing up hungry, or at least facing food insecurity, which is the current terminology for hunger. The numbers run even higher in our region. Both Oregon and California show numbers between 25 and 30%, as in 25 to 30% of children in our states experience hunger at some point. Which is strange when you think about the relative wealth of our country and that we're also a country with many obese people. So what are the issues that lead to hunger, and how are we addressing those? That will be the focus of this hour. We have three guests with us. Philip Yates is the Director of Nutrition Programs at Access Incorporated, which is Jackson County's community action agency. Philip, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Good to have you here. Yeah. Mary Farrell is the founder and executive director of the Maslow Project based in Medford. Mary, we welcome back to The Exchange.
Thank you.
And we also welcome by phone C.J. Drake from the Oregon Youth Authority. Hi, C.J.
Good morning.
CJ, we'll let each of you discuss what the missions of your agencies are in turn. Let's start with you at the Oregon Youth Authority and your recent connection to hunger.
Sure, and thank you again for inviting me to be on your program. The mission of the Oregon Youth Authority is to protect the public and reduce crime by holding youth offenders accountable and providing opportunities for reformation in safe environments. And this year, we were once again honored to participate in the Governor's State Employees Food Drive, which is an annual event organized among the various state agencies to collect food on behalf of the less fortunate in Oregon. And it was conducted in February, and this year's totals were very, very impressive, and we're very proud of the Oregon Youth Authority and our employees who participated, as well as the employees of the other state agencies as well.
What kinds of what amounts of food or money did the OIA folks bring in?
Well, the Oregon Youth Authority this year collected almost 57,000 pounds of food, and that also represents a financial contribution of $13,530. So there's a calculation of dollar per amount of food, but statewide for all state employees, the total amount collected was more than 3.2 million pounds of food donated to the Food Bank Network in Oregon. There were some really remarkable efforts by state agencies, especially the Oregon Department of Forestry, collected 193,444 pounds of food. The Department of Corrections collected 134,916 pounds, almost 135,000 pounds. Then you have the Mortuary and Cemetery Board with five employees, and they collected 16,558 pounds of food. Southern Oregon University, which is part of the state university system and which was part of the governor's state employees food drive, collected almost 13,000 pounds of food among 300 employees. So it was really a tremendous effort, and all of us are very proud and honored to have been able to play a part in helping Oregon's less fortunate.
That is an impressive haul. Let me turn to Philip Yates from Access Incorporated, though. About 3.2 million pounds of food would seem to be a pretty good haul for Oregon food banks.
It is, yeah, it's wonderful. Every year the state employees do this great drive, and it supports us at a time when resources may be a little low, so it's a great boost.
All right, let's talk about Access, Inc. and what it does. As a community action agency, it's been around in one form or another for several decades now, right?
Yes, yeah, since 1976 was the start.
And what does that mean, a community action agency?
It's a national designation specifically, and a community action agency has the job to be able to provide basic services for low-income people in their community. So you'll see lots of community action agencies with different names all across the country, but very similar in their format. So we're obligated to go out to the community every couple of years to get input from clients, from fellow workers, from people in the community to make sure that we're doing the right kind of services in the community. And we focus and continually focus on the basic needs, which are food, housing, and energy assistance, the ones that can make the most difference in a family's life and a family's budget specifically, to be able to have them have enough resources to be able to provide other money for foods that they might need.
So how much food assistance does Access provide over the course of, say, a given year?
Last year, we provided over 45,000 emergency food boxes. That represented over 3.3 million pounds of food.
All right, so that gives us an idea. I was looking for a comparison.
Yeah. I hadn't really kind of caught that one, but yes.
All right, so access alone in Jackson County would send out 3.3 million pounds of food a year, uh-huh. and the state employees' food drive brought in 3.2 million. So there's
perfect,
some idea of just the general scope of the need. Mary Farrell, tell us about the Maslow Project, what it is, and you started it, so why?
Well, I started it because we have just an alarming number of kids in poverty experiencing homelessness, which, of course, is a really broad definition. So we're looking at both kids and families, so from little tiny infants all the way up to families with, teenagers and everything in between who may be having some housing instability. So that could be couch surfing. It could be hotels, cars, camping, but nowhere to get their basic needs met. And so having a lot of need, roughly 2,000 kids in our county, that's about 1 out of 10 school-age kids with a lot of need, there needed to be a resource to help meet that need.
All right, we'll talk about what the Maslow Project does to meet that need when we come back from this break. Philip Yates, Mary Farrell, and CJ Drake are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Hunger Among the Young, the topic. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with our guests and your contact in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today is hunger among children. It is an issue across America, about 1 in 5 children going hungry. In Oregon, the most recent set of figures indicate the rate is more like 29%. Oregon is occasionally listed as the hungriest state for children in the union. California not far behind at 27.3%. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Philip Yates from Access Incorporated, Director of Nutrition Programs. Mary Farrell is the founder and executive director of the Maslow Project. CJ Drake is with the Oregon Youth Authority. Join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. And our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Mary Farrell, we were talking about the fact 2,000 approximately homeless kids in Jackson County at any given time. Does that fluctuate much? And what's the general trend?
The general trend over the last couple of years has been fairly consistent. What we are seeing more of, though, are homeless children. I think most people think homeless kids and they think homeless teenagers. We're actually seeing more and more of that early, childhood age. In fact, the average age of our clients that we work with is 11. And so, of course, that's, homeless in their whole family. So it's not like they're, 11 years old and on the streets by themselves, but the whole family unit might be experiencing homelessness.
And so why the name the Maslow Project? And I imagine you get asked about that a lot.
I do. We actually had a student, he was a junior in high school and he was studying psychology. And he was accessing services from us back in 2007, I think, when we adopted this name. And he was sort of observing that a lot of what we do is try to address those basic needs, so hunger and shelter and safety. And he kind of surmised that what we do is similar to the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which was, philosophy of Abraham Maslow kind of back in the 60s, I think, that states that as human beings, we really can't reach our full potential if our basic survival needs aren't met as sort of a solid foundation from which to grow upon. So the kid that we were working with said, you're sort of like the Maslow Project, and then the name stuck. And so here we are.
Maslow Project still looking to look out for the needs of a homeless youth. Interesting, 11 is the average age now. And yes. Again, these are not, we want to make it clear, not kids running around the street by themselves at age 11.
Right.
But part of a family that is, in fact, homeless.
Yeah, federal law protects kids who lack a regular, fixed, and adequate nighttime residence to make sure they have, appropriate access to education and some other things. And so that sort of definition is broad. But really, we're looking at kids who don't always know where they're going that night. They might not always know where their next meal is coming from. And how do you really think about school and how to advance yourself in life when you're always wondering how to get your basic needs met?
Given the Maslow hierarchy of needs, and granted, it is not a strict construction on that, I'm sure. But I mean, do you prioritize, though, which things need to be taken care of in which order?
We really do, because it's really hard to ask a child to focus or commit to higher level goals when, hunger is such a basic primal driving factor of why anybody does anything. I mean, you think about ourselves, we get out of bed and the first thing we do is go find coffee or, you know, find some breakfast. So when you're chronically hungry and you never know where your next meal is going to come from, it tends to occupy a lot of your brain power. And so we really do prioritize meeting those basic needs first and foremost through the help of a lot of our community partners. We certainly can't do it by ourselves. And then once we've addressed, you know, hunger, safety, warmth, those basic issues, then we can really start to prioritize things like education and employment and, you know, setting higher level goals for kids.
Let us take a call. We have one already. Here's John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking youth hunger with Mary Farrell from the Maslow Project, Philip Yates from Access, and C.J. Drake from the Oregon Youth Authority. Hi, John.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I guess your guest just answered a lot of my question, but my question is kind of two-part. One is I volunteered at Fish for a while here in Grants Pass, and so I kind of got the idea that there's kind of two different types of homeless. My original idea was everybody was living under the stars, but that's not necessarily the case. A lot of people did have a roof over their head. So I guess my question, first of all, for your guest is, how's that kind of divided up when you talk about homelessness? And what? And I guess the second thing is, in terms of hunger, I'm also, you know, are these people who had nothing to eat for the entire day, or they just, anyway, any definition, because I still don't really know what either one of them quite means.
Okay, good to bring that up. Thanks so much, John. Appreciate it. Mary, you can take on the homeless part, and then we'll give Philip the hunger part.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say regarding youth homelessness, which is kind of where my expertise is, the federal government really defines that again as any child who lacks a regular, fixed, and adequate nighttime residence.
Is there a definition for adequate?
It's subjective, and that's why there's people like myself who are required to work in every public school system across the United States. And it really is intended to make sure that kids who may be in unsafe, unstable, unsanitary, so lacking fixed, you know, like if they're camping and they're moving around a lot or they may be couch surfing, they don't always know where they're going. It may not always be a safe place that they're going to, even if there's technically a roof over their head. The idea is that it's removing the program is to remove barriers that those kids may have to accessing their education. So making sure that they still have transportation to school, that they're not having to move to five different schools a year every time they move, making sure that they're connected to resources so that they can stay in school and focus on their education. So we do actually kind of, you know, figure out of the total number of kids, how many are truly on the streets, how many are couch surfing, how many may be camping or sleeping in a shelter. So we do report that data to the state, but they all face very similar challenges and barriers, and one of them is hunger. And so that's kind of why they're kind of lumped together in one category, why homeless is such a broad definition when we look at youth.
All right. So Philip Yates and Access, director of the nutrition programs there, when we are talking about hunger and food insecurity, what are there lines that are drawn there? You know, this kid's hungry, this kid has food insecurity, this kid is neither, you know, that sort of thing?
You know, I think it's been interesting that the progress of the state of hunger in Oregon, and it's been all over the place. And we found in 2000 that we were number one in hunger, and there was a real issue. In order to be able to try and turn that around, one of the most important issues was getting federal nutrition programs for children into schools specifically to make sure that children were fed every day. But still, even today in Jackson County, even though there's about 15,000 children who are eligible, we only have about 9,000 that participate in free lunches and meals and such. So we still need to raise the bar in terms of getting food to children. And then in the summertime, when we also experience an increase in need in the food banks, we know that those children who didn't get who were able to get food help during the year from the schools, if there's not summer lunches available for them, that makes it extra difficult for them during the summertime particularly.
Why are so many people leaving essentially dollars on the table, or at least meals on the table, that they're eligible for? I mean, I know we get the same sort of thing with SNAP, the food stamp program, Oregon Trail, Cal Fresh for our two states. And it looks like Mary has an idea about this.
I do know that in the schools there tends to be some stigma, especially with the older kids, sort of the free lunch program. And so we have a lot of kids who, you know, whether it's true or not, they perceive it to be sort of a stigmatizing program. And so we work really hard to get them signed up for the free lunch program anyway, sort of jump through that stigma for them so that they have access to food. We also, you know that there's families who the paperwork itself is just sort of a barrier. Mm-hmm. So they either perceive it as sort of too difficult, or even just accessing food stamps. It's sort of a difficult process for them. So we work really hard to try to integrate our services with the school lunch program and with DHS Food SNAP program so that we have someone on site who can help our families navigate through that process more easily.
Yeah, but I believe the school send out a letter each year at the beginning of the year to have people qualify for the lunches. And then during the year, it's made available to them. But as Mary said, it's a question of the family specifically making that effort to be able to go there and the stigmatism that's involved in that. We find that the same thing when people come to the food pantries. It's a pride issue. They just don't want to be seen at the food pantry, and especially for men, it seems more important that they want to hide that the issue that they hold for themselves. And it's the kids that really drive their families in to the food banks.
Because it's the kids who are going to express their hunger.
The kids are going to express their hunger.
Yeah, we have kids come in to Maslow Project, and we always keep fresh produce and bread sort of by the front door, and it's free. Take all you want. And then we'll have a couple snack bins that have things like granola bars, raisins. Our kids will come in, and they will just start packing their backpacks, their pockets, every square inch on their body that they can stuff food into so they can take it with them so they have food for later. They will. And so we try to make as much of it readily available as they can. We'll sometimes send them home with backpacks full of food for the weekend just because we know they're so hungry.
Yeah, I remember we served some lunches some years ago in White City. And similarly, we had some youth, some teenagers there who would come back for seconds and thirds even. You know, you knew probably that wasn't the only meal, probably the only meal that they had today and maybe the only meal that they had in the last 24 hours.
Really? So it is to that level, right?
It is. I mean, we've had kids come in for the first time and report that they've been sort of living off one teaspoon of peanut butter at a time and making it last for days. And so, you know, that's how we know it's a serious problem.
We were talking about hunger among young people, specifically in the state of Oregon, with Mary Farrell, who's the founder and executive director of the Maslow Project, based in Medford. Philip Yates is the director of nutrition programs at Access, Inc., also based in Medford. C.J. Drake is with the Oregon Youth Authority. Join us on The Exchange. You may have lots of questions and a few ideas about how to improve things. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. C.J. Drake, I don't want to draw a line if there is none here, but are there stories of childhood hunger behind most of the people supervised by the Oregon Youth Authority?
Well, I don't know what kind of hunger the young people that we take in experience. They probably experience some. However, when they do arrive at OYA, we do a comprehensive health assessment of each one of them. And then, of course, once they are in one of our close custody facilities, and actually we have a close custody facility in Grants Pass, the Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility, which was a wonderful participant in the Food Drive Project, they are well fed and fed according to federal food guidelines and nutritional guidelines, just like a public school would, because the last thing we need is to introduce another unstable factor in these young people's lives who've already been traumatized enough, and that's hunger. So if they're content and if they're well fed, it's going to lead to a safer and more secure environment for everyone.
And you mentioned a health assessment coming in. I mean, generally, are the people who arrive at the OIA facilities in reasonably good health? Are they somewhat not so much? I mean, what's the general trend there?
Well, based on the figures that we have, there's usually some kind of traumatic experience or drug or alcohol abuse that they've encountered or experienced or suffered in their lives. For example, among males, almost 70% have abused alcohol or drugs in their lives, 81% of females in the same category, 58% of males, their parents have abused alcohol or drugs. In the same category, 72% of females. So they usually come to OIA with some kind of trauma in their lives, and that's what probably motivated them to commit their offense in the first place. And we do everything we can to rectify that through treatment, educational education and vocational opportunities once they're at OIA, because eventually they're going to return to their communities, and we're doing everything we can to make sure that they lead productive, crime-free lives when they do.
Mary Farrell, I see you nodding over there at the other side of the table from me, which is the advantage of having people in the studio here. So, I mean, is there a continuum here? If the people are not served well when they are homeless kids, are they likely to end up in an OIA?
I wouldn't draw that direct correlation. We definitely have some, you know, youth crossover with juvenile justice and so forth, but I wouldn't say that, you know, all homeless kids turn to crime.
Didn't want to draw too bright a line there.
But there is certainly a prevalence of, you know, drug and alcohol abuse, you know, sort of untreated mental illness, sort of systemic poverty-related depression or traumatic events, like CJ was saying, that kind of lead to acting out that can get kids in trouble. And sometimes they just really, you know, have made some unfortunate decisions, but based on not having a lot of mentorship, not having a solid structure for which they're, you know, growing up and receiving direction in life. So, you know, we definitely, I agree with that assessment that usually there's some form of trauma that's occurred that contributes to that. But certainly, and I wouldn't say it's a poverty specific, it's more, you know, holistic than that.
All right. More generally, though, on hunger and children, what have the trends been like in recent years? Philip Yates at Access.
Can I just want to make the point a little bit, going back even a little further.
Sure.
We're talking about youth. To me, nutrition goes back to the very, very early years of childhood in terms of, and we see families consistently who are struggling with poverty and issues around hunger, and their kids don't have adequate enough food in those first 3 years, and makes it really difficult for them to develop in the right way, to be able to be a part of our community in a full way. So, I mean, I don't want to draw the conclusions either necessarily, but by the same token, the importance for me is starting younger and making sure that these children and these families have enough good nutritional food to eat.
It's the good launch. It's very more important at the beginning.
And I can sort of illustrate that point with a story, and I'll just say this would be a family that we've worked with over the last decade, so it'd be very,
right, very general.
Very general. But, you know, there was a 10-year-old that I recall who had learned from a family member how to sell prescription pills for money to buy food for the family. And really at 10 years old, just didn't appreciate or have a concept. I mean, I think he realized it was wrong, but didn't really, you know, really appreciate sort of the legal and the criminal sort of aspect of his actions. He was truly trying to just get food for his younger siblings.
Wow. And at 10 years old.
At 10 years old.
Mm-hmm. And where was he getting the prescription drugs?
Just mom, dad, family.
Mm-hmm. And did they even know?
I think that he learned that behavior. And I don't necessarily know that they were selling for food. I think they were selling for more drugs. But the children were just so chronically hungry that it sort of was a learned behavior to acquire resources to feed, you know, the children and the family.
All right. So, again, let's talk about trends in recent years. I mean, obviously the recession is considered to be behind us, mm-hmm. although there's still a lot of people not really feeling like they've gotten back to where they were.
Right.
I know there's been a lot said about food banks getting hit a lot harder. People who were once donors became recipients during the recession. Has that finally stabilized, turned into a downward trend again? Where do things stand for Access?
Not a downward trend. We just recently, I think in the middle of 2013, experienced our biggest month ever in terms of number of families coming for food.
Really?
And it hasn't subsided. We're looking at an average of closer to 3,800 families a month compared with a year or two ago of 3,400. So that's going up. What we're seeing also is the family size is getting larger too. And we're kind of making a jump with that. We feel that a lot of the families are coming together, grandparents, parents and children are coming together under the same roof because they may have enough resources to be able to provide for the family. So consequently, we don't see any change in that necessarily, and those numbers are keeping on increasing.
All right. So interesting. So the extended family is sort of coming back into vogue now, but not for any reason other than need.
Survival.
Mm-hmm. Survival is what it is. All right, we were talking about hunger among young people in our region. Philip Yates and Mary Farrell here. Philip Yates is from Access. Mary Farrell is the executive director and founder of the Maslow Project. We also have C.J. Drake from the Oregon Youth Authority with us. We will take a short break and come back to the Jefferson Exchange. You can join this discussion at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Back to talk more about youth and hunger and how to address the issues when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about hunger among young people, a continuing issue in this country. About one in five children considered hungry in America, or at least facing food insecurity. The numbers are higher in both Oregon and California. One recent set of statistics indicated that Oregon is the hungriest state in the nation for children. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the issue with Philip Yates, the Director of Nutrition Programs at Access from Jackson County. Mary Farrell is the founder and executive director of the Maslow Project based in Medford. C.J. Drake is with the Oregon Youth Authority. Our phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about caseloads, and Philip was letting us know that there are actually more people coming in for food now than had been for us. You're seeing about 3,800 families a month, where it was 3,400, mm-hmm. even through the recession. Mary, what's happening with the caseloads at the Maslow Project?
You know, we are probably on track to serve around 2,000 kids this year, and that's up a lot from last year at about 1,600. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, the average age of the youth that we serve is 11. So we're really seeing more and more kids at a younger age. Sometimes they're young parents with, you know, little kids, and sometimes they're established parents. But for this year, we've got over 300 kids already who are under the age of five. So I think that trend is, you know, the family situations are getting, you know, like Philip said, they're combining households to share resources, but creating sort of instability for the youth in the process.
The what are the general circumstances then for the kids that you serve through the Maslow Project? And again, it is aimed at homeless children, and the average age 11.
Mm-hmm.
Is it often that they're just couch surfing? Is it often that they're living in the car with the family?
It's such a combination of different circumstances. I mean, we do have kids who are unaccompanied youth, they're not with a parent or guardian because they've had to leave a very unsafe situation at home, either with, you know, abuse or neglect. But we also have families who've just lost their jobs, or they may have lost their mortgage and are kind of new to homelessness and really don't know how to navigate the social service system, just reaching out for help. Families really just struggling to meet their own basic needs and can't afford things like clothes for school or even the school meal program. If you don't qualify for free, it's usually a barrier for families to actually pay even the, what is it, I think $1.80 a meal, and that adds up really fast. And so I wouldn't say that all families who are experiencing homelessness are there for the same reasons. You know, they didn't all get there the same way, but the barriers to basic needs and school are kind of all similar.
We were talking about the barriers during the last break here and about the general obstacles that exist out there. So, I mean, you just mentioned a couple there, Mary. Philip, what are some of the ones that you notice through the work at Access, through the nutrition programs there, the things that just stop people from being able to feed their families?
Yeah, it's that pride issue. I really believe that families feel as though they should provide for their children. You know, that's the society that we have there, where we feel responsible, which is great. But by the same token, you know, for me, I see it as a community problem, as a community support problem. So we need to provide support as much as possible to those families.
What are some of the programs that are offered now? There is some educational component to both your programs, I would think, to help people understand a little more about nutrition and getting good nutrition to their kids.
Right, right. We have a number of programs that we have introduced over the last year or two. We've got heavily involved in the general food system work, but primarily we're doing cooking demonstration classes at food pantries right now, which are really successful. I'm really blown away with the response. It's a train-the-trainer model, and we have 50 to 60 volunteers in the last 2 months who have been trained to go out and do food demonstrations at food pantries across the county.
How are the food pantries arranged? I mean, do they all talk to one another? I mean, if you've nobody's ever turned away per se, I would think.
No. We work with a network of 25 food pantries across the county. Those are emergency food pantries, but in addition to that, there are some supplemental food pantries that we work with as well. We have a general. We're trying to make sure that a family gets, in average, about 20 pounds per person. So a family of three would come away with 60 to 65 pounds of food, which would be about 5 to 7 days, we hope.
Okay, 5 to 7 days.
But the struggle is with the increasing need, how do you keep up with that? You know, where does the food keep coming from? We've kind of looked at different avenues. We gather food from stores that's meat and different products like that. But right now, where we see across the whole state is the next way we can get food to people is we're getting fresh produce. So we're looking at California, and we were hopeful, before the drought situation seems to be coming, that we would be able to increase the amount of fresh produce by 50% over the next year or two. But I'm not sure that may be in doubt a little bit now with the drought that's happening in California.
Given that some things simply won't be planted this planting season.
Yeah, yeah.
C.J. Drake at the Oregon Youth Authority, I want to come back to you for just a moment, because when we talk about the numbers and just the amount of food that has to be moved around to address hunger issues, one of the first things we heard was that all state employees brought in 3.2 million pounds of food, and we've already established that that's about what Access puts out in a month, is it, Philip?
No.
In a year.
No, a month.
Not a month.
We'd love to have that.
Yeah,
problem.
In a year, okay. Yeah. So basically what came in through one food drive through all the state employees in February of this year is what Access puts out approximately in 1 year. What does that tell you about the issue of hunger in the state of Oregon? That's for you, CJ.
Well, I really have to commend the generosity of the state employees who participated, and also the generosity of just average Oregonians who understand and perceive and appreciate the extent and the need of the issue. So I think that's a wonderful turnout for 1 month as well, but also it's a continuing need throughout the year, and we certainly support and commend the efforts of all Oregonians to help meet that need. One of the great features of the Governor's State Employees Food Drive is that food donated in the local community stays in the local community. So, for example, the amount of food collected at Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility in Grants Pass, for example, that was picked up by the Josephine County Food Bank and distributed throughout the community. In total, the amount of staff that we have in Southern Oregon, our probation and parole staff and our facility staff, all of those folks collected nearly 4,000 pounds of food for the community in Southern Oregon.
All right. I want to ask, I guess this question has not been asked yet. Why? Why Oregon? Why is Oregon so hungry? Any ideas from either Philip Yates or Mary Farrell?
Well, yeah. I mean, for here in Jackson County, and I think generally across the state, is we have such a high cost of living in terms of housing issues. I mean, housing, generally, when I think about housing, I think about 30 to 34% of my budget. You know, that's what I'm aiming at. But for people we see, they're talking about 70% of their budget. 50 to 70% of their budget. So when you take that away, there's only 30 to 40% more resources to pay for
utility, everything else.
And so there's generally not enough. And where can you cut budget? You're going to cut it with food. And unfortunately, if you cut it with food, you're probably going to buy food that fill you up momentarily, but maybe not good nutritionally. So we, you know, you mentioned earlier on in the program, I think of problems with obesity and other problems around nutrition. I think we have that also in Oregon. But I think it's that cost of living relative to the income in our area. And we certainly have a lot of service industry jobs in our community that don't, you know, are seasonal and maybe part-time. They certainly don't pay for the cost of living here.
I have to believe that that's something you're seeing, too, with the Maslow Project, Mary Farrell, that the reason that people are ending up homeless is because their homes did cost that much.
Oh, absolutely. It's just lack of income to either afford sort of the down payment, the deposit to get into housing. You know, the cost of housing is expensive, you know, and employment is tough. You know, we're seeing a situation where our young people, our teenagers, are really struggling to find those typical, you know, we think of high school jobs because adults are, you know, adults are filling those jobs.
Fast food jobs.
Yeah, and
like
we're
that.
Talking mm-hmm. minimum wage, and yeah, mm-hmm. they're trying to feed a family on that.
Let's take a call. We have Laura in Grants Pass on the phone. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about hunger among the youth with Philip Yates, Mary Farrell, and C.J. Drake.
Hi. I'm a letter carrier here in Grants Pass, and I just wanted to let everybody know that coming up in a couple weeks is the National Association of Letter Carriers Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive, and anybody can help, you know, families in their local communities by just putting some mail food out by their mailbox.
Okay, is there a specific bag that comes with this or something, or just an
Yeah,
bag?
You'll get a postcard in the mail the week of, and we'll also be delivering bags, or you can use your own grocery bags or however you want to do it, but any non-perishables will. We do this. This is our 22nd year of doing it, and I was just listening to the show and thought it'd be a good thing to remind everybody about.
Absolutely, that's May 10th, Saturday, May 10th, then for the Stamp Out Hunger.
Yes.
Okay, and so just leave the food out by the mailbox. You'll get a postcard that week, you say.
That's right.
Great. Thanks for the reminder, Laura. That's great to hear about that.
All right, no problem.
Thanks
a lot.
Which I had another question here, too, Philip Yates, about how much some of the other hunger-fighting programs that have risen in recent years have helped. I mean, we talked to the folks at the Food Project, which mm-hmm. began as the Ashland mm-hmm. Food Project, mm-hmm. and now it's right. Ashland, Medford, Phoenix, mm-hmm. Talent. You mm-hmm. got, they all got them. Mm-hmm. Collected their first 1,000,000 pounds of food as
right.
of last
That's
fall sometime.
Amazing. That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it's a community effort. I mean, you know, we have the state employees doing their bit in February. Now in May, we have the federal employees doing their bit. You know, and the community comes forward, as you mentioned, in the food projects. I mean, the food project, every 2 months now across the county is drawing in 60,000 to 70,000 pounds of food. Which is pretty phenomenal, pretty phenomenal, and the important thing is, I think, is for me, the food project is about raising food, but it's about raising community awareness and community support. You know, because as we're talking about these issues, which are not so easy to solve, we need help and support to be able to solve them. So this is a great avenue for that, to be able to get that kind of support.
And I would say there's a few other avenues, too. I mean, we work with a lot of faith-based communities,
yes.
you know, civic organizations, youth organizations who just, you know, do their part and they do food drives and they, you know, distribute it to places that feed, you know, hungry people and especially children. So, and sometimes we just get individuals who they're going to Costco and they pick up an extra box of granola bars or, mm-hmm. you know, Top Ramen or whatever it is that they can contribute. And so, the community effort, everything from the food shares to, you know, the Girl Scout troop that raised food, it's all part of the solution.
So what else is needed? Let me ask each of you in turn, and I'll start with you, Mary. So if you got to be king of the world for a day, queen of the world, sorry, and say, okay, here's what's going to happen. This is how we're going to address hunger. What would be the steps that are not yet in existence that you would say we need to do?
Oh, my gosh. I don't think I could answer that question in 2 minutes. You know, I still am convinced that there's a lot of food that gets wasted. You know, there's as much as we try, you know, I know that there's a lot of waste in our country in general. And so, you know, making sure that doesn't happen and that food actually gets into the hands of the people who need it, you know, increasing the amount of fresh, highly nutritious organic kinds of foods, I think, really goes a long way to increasing the health and sort of the brain functioning of the kids who are ingesting this food. So I would definitely want to see all food that lacks nutritional value and it's just filler and junk, while we recognize that it's calories and it's helping keep kids alive. I wish that all food that was available was nutritious and good for their bodies. Those would be just sort of the places I would start.
Good place to start. Philip Yates, how about you?
I guess I'm imagining a family sitting at a table and having a good, nutritious meal on a daily basis and being a family, you know, so that the food is the source of the family and the community coming together. Because I think, you know, we lose that. And, you know, it used to be, you know, people were doing in their different directions, families, and then they would come together at least once a day for a meal. That doesn't happen for many families today.
Which is a big deal. I mean, there is a PSA campaign, a public service announcement campaign, that indicates that that families that eat together, at least for the one meal a day, there's less incidence of drug abuse and youth crime and a lot of other things.
That would be my hope for the future.
Me too.
All right. C.J. Drake, you want to weigh in here with what you'd like to do to see be done to address hunger?
Sure, and those are all wonderful suggestions. I think the more that we can do to raise and promote awareness of the issue, maybe there's a lot of folks out there who aren't even aware that hunger is such an acute issue in Oregon. So programs even like the one we're participating in this morning, if it can even educate and raise the awareness among one or a few people, I think it does a lot. You know, as I was listening to the program over the phone, it occurred to me that there, regardless of your age, there are a few things in life that produce more anxiety than not knowing where your next meal is coming from. So if this food drive and others like it can introduce some measure of stability and predictability in the lives of those folks, it'll be well worth it.
All right. I want to thank you all for joining us to talk about hunger among youth in Oregon. C.J. Drake is with the Oregon Youth Authority. Mary Farrell is the founder and executive director of the Maslow Project. And Philip Yates is the director of nutrition programs at Access. Good to have you all today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about preps for the coming wildfire season. Our Vents Day segment returns for the first time in 3 weeks. We'll talk about gun laws and about firing teachers. Then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of the book, The Art of Tinkering. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of JPR. And have a great day.